Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. In today's episode, we will discuss how to think about restarting our economies, based both on how effective measures have been in terms of what we did last year, but also in terms of progress that we're now making in vaccinating our population. We're going to ask questions like, have the money that governments put into the economies helped? And in what sense did they help? And as we move forward, how can we perhaps think about removing, phasing out some of these measures? I am Maria Demergis, I'm the Deputy Director at Bruegel, and I'm joined today to discuss these issues with three prominent academics who have done a lot of research on this issue. Professor Stefan Müller, welcome Stefan, thank you for joining us.
Hey Maria, hi, nice to see you.
Stefan is a professor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research, and he's also the head of the Department of Structural Change and Productivity. I'm then joined by Filippo Di Mauro. Hello, Filippo. Thank you for joining.
Hello. Hello.
Filippo is a professor at the Business School at the National University of Singapore, and he's also the chairman of CompNet, which is a large research network on competitiveness and productivity among institutions. And some of the research that he's done in the context of CompTech will be very useful in informing the discussion today. And last but not least, I'm joined by Carlo Altomonte. Carlo, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Maria. Hi to all of you.
Carlo is a professor of economics at Bocconi University and non-resident fellow at Bruegel. Thank you all for joining for this discussion. We have actually started this discussion some time ago, and I'm glad to continue it on issues of productivity, of how some of the money that we have put into protecting their economies has been spent, whether it's spent well, and what we learn from this. In the past year, I think it's fair to say that all countries in Europe, individually and collectively, have put massive amounts of money to try and sustain whatever economic activity is possible. I think what we want to do today, a year and a bit after the first close down, is understand whether the money was well spent. And what do we do next? Can we continue to support the economies quite the same way that we've done before? And if not, then how do we go about removing some of these measures? So, Carlo, if I may start with you, because I've had a number of conversations with you on these issues. And you, I know you've worked extensively on Italy and trying to understand how much money was given to companies and to what effect. I mean, is it fair to say that the money has really helped in terms of sustaining employment and instead of, protecting a productive capacity?
Yeah, I would say definitely yes. I mean, the amount of money that Italy and all the other European countries have been able to put forward has been unprecedented. It combines overall to several points of GDP for Italy. This is around 7 points of GDP in total, and this is a comparable figure with Germany or France. And on the other, this is a roughly 4 or 5 times larger than what Italy put forward during the previous crisis, 2008-2009. Figures are a bit smaller for France, which put a bit more in 2008-2009 compared to nowadays, and definitely larger for Germany. Also notable is the similarity in terms of aids that the countries have put together. The three big European countries have put forward, all three of them, a lot of money on wage retention schemes. So Cassa Integrazione in Italy, Kurzarbeit in Germany, and Chômage Partiel in France, in order to keep workers employed and keep cash flowing and wages flowing. And that has sustained consumption and has, if you want, allowed for some elements of social peace insofar. The other key element that the three countries, and this is a distinct feature also with respect to other countries and the United States, have put forward is this guarantees, that public guarantees that the three countries have put in terms of loans to companies. So basically companies could borrow money from banks, and banks were protected from the risk of these loans between 80% to 100%, according to the different schemes that have been put forward, of course, within the framework of the state aid negotiated by the European Commission. So companies could actually borrow money from banks, and the banks are protected by the state guarantee. So if a company ends up not repaying the loan when the pandemic is over, the state will step in.
That's right.
Now, the key question is precisely this one. Who got these loans? How many of them? In the case of Italy, we're talking about 150, 160 billion of euros. Whether we have evidence that these loans are going to be repaid or not. The question is crucial because if there is evidence that these loans are not going to be repaid, clearly that creates two types of problems. A problem in terms of increase in the amount of public debt, given the size of the public guarantees that have been put forward, and a problem in terms of, for the part not covered by the state guarantee, a problem in terms of non-performing loans in the banking system, which on the other end might create a credit crunch when a credit crunch should not be precisely in the recovery phase. Now, the evidence
Carlo, I mean, that element of where the money, you know, whether those loans that were given out, whether they are going to be repaid. I mean, that's crucial, right? Because we're also talking about a lot of money. But at the first instance, I mean, the COVID, the shutdown came very quickly. And what the intention of government help was very much actually to try and protect people in employment. So in that respect, if you look at the numbers, employment was protected. And I think if I may turn to Stefan, because Stefan, you have done research on Germany in this respect. And, you know, we see that all of the government support that was given, first and foremost, managed to protect employment, right? Isn't that the evidence from Germany?
So as Carlo mentioned, we had this type of loans giving out to firms and other support, and in particular this short-time work scheme, that Kurzarbeit in German. What we have seen is that the unemployment numbers did not rise dramatically. That's really good news. And as Carlo said, of course, all this sustained consumption at the high level. So that's all good. And maybe one of the most surprising outcomes of the last year for many European countries was that actually corporate bankruptcies decreased, right? So it's not, we have a crisis in corporate bankruptcies in many countries decreased, right? So for Germany, we saw that the number of bankruptcy who has been low before the pandemic now even declined during the pandemic. So this is a stunning result.
It is a stunning result, but isn't this a little bit artificial, right? I mean, first of all, companies were not allowed to go bankrupt. So that in itself is telling you that. I mean, the intention here is to try and, try and save companies from unnecessary death. Isn't that what the objective was, Stefan?
I think in the short run, the idea was really to say, okay, look, there will be no disaster in the first place. Because the pandemic, of course, was hitting firms of very different types. So typically weak firms go bankrupt, right? But in the pandemic, also very good firms have been under threat.
Exactly. Right?
And of course, the short-time aim of this was to safeguard the good firms and the good jobs. And the measure that has been taken in Germany and many other countries was really to, exempt firms from filing for bankrupt, although they would have been bankrupt according to usual measures, right?
And, exactly.
And so the aim is really, and this I think was a good policy at the beginning, really to say, calm down, you don't have to go bankrupt. We will see and wait and then come up with other support measures. And this is actually, I think this was a very good policy, and it spared us a lot of unnecessary bankruptcies.
Yeah.
But you're right, of course. I mean, this lasted for many months, and we had exemptions until end of April, actually, of this year. And then the question is, okay, was that still a good policy or not? I guess we will come to this later, right?
Yes, indeed. I think we need to, I mean, you know, we absolutely need to come back to this and sort of see how this evolves. I mean, I think if you look at the numbers, bankruptcies are still much lower than what they were pre-pandemic. So, you know, we need to ask the questions, is this a good thing or a bad thing? And up to what point is it a good thing? And after that, it's not a good thing. But before I do that, Filippo, you also looked at numbers in different countries. Do you agree that this was necessary? It was useful, but, you know, it has got an expiry date.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much, Maria. And so I think that, in fact, one issue here is the diversity of the impacts across countries and across sectors. That was the main thing. So that's why I'm thinking that along the lines of the philosophy of component, the analysis of cross-country is here very critical. Because it's true, there were lower or no bankruptcies, because actually, as Stefan was mentioning, at the time were just not allowed. So the issue, however, is whether the shock was temporary or permanent. And here, the question is very much country and sector specific, because, of course, it will depend on the nature, the structure of the economies. So, in particular, their specific dependence on certain sectors, type of activities affected, as well as the gravity of the lockdown. So the cross-country comparison and even cross-sectors comparison, cross-firms comparison is critical. We cannot really just respond to say it was yes or good. So, it really depends. So I will, in the next few, sort of rounds, show you what diversity I found. But the message is clear. There was an immense diversity across countries and across sectors.
Indeed. And I think, we've heard terms like the K recovery, which is basically another way of saying there have been losers and winners of this shock. And the question is, whether the scarring effects are permanent and what can we do about, removing some of the divergences that have emerged. There is a trade-off between implementing policies quickly and timely, which is, of course, what's needed in the shutdown, but also having policies that are focused enough to be of value. I think it's fair to say that during the pandemic, we had to act quickly, right? And we had to act quickly with very big measures. And I mean, in Europe, I think the measures were very, very big. And as I said earlier on, both at the national level and at the supranational level. But they have been indiscriminate as a result of that, right? And the question is, have they been unnecessarily indiscriminate? I don't know if I may come back to Carlo, do you find evidence that actually, that degree of indiscriminate nature of the measures was contained?
So what the OECD named those policies, blanket measures.
Indeed.
Because you just throw a blanket of money over the entire economy, precisely because you would otherwise have had a type 2 error, in the sense you would have the unnecessary bankruptcies. So you have to throw money at the economy, keep everyone afloat. And now the point, as Stefan was mentioning, is that given the fact that the nature of the shock might be different across sectors, across regions within countries, how do you target, how do you withdraw this measure, you phase out these measures, and moving from a blanket approach to a more targeted approach of the policies. Now, the evidence that we have been able to put together in Italy and Stefan in Germany and in other scholars in France is that at least the crisis seems to be in a way productive, efficient from the point of view of productivity. We call it the cleansing effect of the crisis. So in the sense that being this a liquidity shock, this liquidity shock has affected almost by definition smaller and relatively less productive firms. So if tomorrow we withdraw all of a sudden all the support measures, we will probably see many small and relatively unproductive firms going into bankruptcy. And therefore, for a, if you want, Darwinian selection process, what we would have is that the remaining firms would be on average more productive. So the selection effect of the crisis would go in the right direction, if you want, boosting overall productivity.
Yeah, but Carlo, so, if I may, that is also...
This opens, however, a big social problem because...
Also, the economy is much smaller, right? I mean, you take away the non-productive firms, but then you... And of course, on average, only the productive firms remain, but the economy is much smaller, right?
So in the first place, yes, of course.
Yes, in the first place.
So there is an issue of phasing out with a lot of attention these measures. First of all, because as you said, if you remove them all of a sudden, you would have this shrinking of the economy, which would have general equilibrium consequences in the long run. And second, because employment is concentrated relatively more in these small and relatively unproductive firms. So paradoxically, we do not have much of a worrying about the guarantees of the financial part or the financial implication of these loans given to companies. We do have a lot of attention on the employment consequences that a too sudden withdrawal of these resources might generate. And this is, I think, one message that we have to keep in mind. And therefore, here, what Filippo was mentioning, we have to keep it in really, and the analysis would be very important to tell us which industries have recovered faster, which industries will recover later, so that we can differentiate by industry or by region the type of phasing out measures in a way that allows those companies that have already recovered to retain employment once the measures, the support measures are unwound, versus retaining some support in those industries that would otherwise generate unemployment and layoffs if the measures are, if you want, removed too quickly. This is the delicate balance that I think every government in Europe will have to face over the next months.
Well, let's hear also from other countries. Stefan, do you also observe this? I think cleansing effect is the term, that it is the weakest firms that have been affected during the crisis in Germany.
So yes, so indeed, we found that. But let me maybe say a few words on the indiscriminate nature of policies first. So indeed, also in Germany, we have seen mostly indiscriminate type of support right at the beginning, and that's, of course, I mean, it was very sudden. Policy had to react, and there's no one to blame. But the point is that after several months, there would have been a chance actually to change this and to come up with more targeted policies, right? And I think of the short-time work scheme, for instance, in Germany. Policymakers in August 2020 decided to prolong it without any further conditions until end of 21. So they could not know that there is a third wave or something. But could it well been that in February or March this year, COVID is more or less gone, the economy is kicking in again, and we would in this case have a clear understanding on who would still actually use short-time work in such a situation. It would definitely be the weak firms that will not recover, and they would block resources, so workers would to a larger extent stay in these firms, and they could not move to the firms that really need workers. So this was unnecessary, and economists actually said, look, why don't you condition this on the firms being viable before the crisis at least, right? And there was, for instance, the head of the German Council of Economic Advisors proposed this very prominently, but policy ignored it. So this was, I think, the first thing, and many observers say, okay, maybe it has to do something with the upcoming elections in 21 in Germany. So, it may.
I mean, you know, I think one of the things we always say is that the level of uncertainty, economic uncertainty, but also pandemic uncertainty, is so big that you might want to err on the side of doing too much rather than doing too little, right? And you know, irrespective of the motives of decisions, I think it's fair to say that, first of all, there is huge uncertainties. And secondly, remember that you and I may be vaccinated, but the rest of the world is not. And, you know, nobody's safe till everybody's safe. You know, allowing for the possibility of erring on the side of caution might not be a very bad motive if you're trying to handle uncertainty. The question is, however, that this is going to cost us money, right? And this is what you mean, Stefan, right? I mean, can we continue to support indiscriminately?
It's not about only fiscal. I mean, it's also about productivity, right? If you block resources in bad firms, we inhibit growth. And the question, and that's a big theme that we have also when we talk about phasing out. And just supporting Carlo's evidence for Italy, we saw with German microdata that indeed the least productive firms have been much more likely after the first wave to say, well, we have been hit hard by the crisis, and they also report that they are close to exit. So this is a clear gradient by productivity. But having said that, 20% of the most productive firms also reported to having been hit hard. So that's much less than among the least productive firms, but still, it's a many very good firms. And we have to keep this in mind. So the cleansing effect would be very costly in Germany if you take these numbers at face value. So the question is really about how to phase out, how to safeguard the good firms when phasing out these policies.
Indeed. One thing, Maria, on that, I don't know if I can intervene a bit. I think we need the clarity here because there's a bit of putting together two items which are, in my opinion, very different. One thing is basically identify the right firm, right, quote unquote. So the firm that eventually was, you know, in the past, deserving, right, the productive one. But in the future, is not only that, is also, as I was mentioning before, the sector that the, you know, this firm is in, right, could be very productive, but the you know, it could be the sector entirely deleted, right? So I think we need the conceptually to distinguish, you know, sort of the match between subsidies and you know, goodness of the firm versus the future, which is related to which sector or which part of that sector will survive. And to make you a very, very concrete example on the first part, we have been doing some analysis using micro data of component for a number, say three Eastern Europe countries, Croatia, Slovenia and Slovakia, so relatively small countries. We have micro data for the past, so we can identify how they performed the firms, so we're talking about 100,000 of firms for those countries, in the past, say, 4 or 5 years, right? So what we did, however, the data are past, because as we know, firm-level data are available with a delay of about 2 years, 1 year, and a half or so. But what we had is be able to identify those firms and the amount of subsidies in terms of wages and in terms of rent that those firms were getting, right? So what we basically did was kind of say, okay, there were a certain amount of subsidies, to which firm they went. And we clustered those firms in certain categories. So big firms, firms that were growing fast, productive firms, zombie firms, or you know, firms that were surviving, they were not supposed to survive, right? So, and here the result was actually quite comforting, I would say, that meaning to say that true, there was a blanket, but this blanket actually was not really bringing about, in our evaluation for those three countries, a full misallocation of public funds. Because, you know, let me give you just two or three results that we get out of this analysis. First is that the most of the subsidies actually went to medium-sized and medium-productive firms. So, in a sense, it was distributed to the average, right? So not the bad or not the very good, right? So, which is, you know, at the end of the day, is not necessarily too negative. Now, how about the bigger productive firms? Well, those ones were receiving a relatively low share, right? So this could be, say, somewhat a misallocation. But on the other hand, however, if we think about, if we compute how much the zombie firms, so the firms that actually in the past 4 or 5 years of our sample were in fact totally dead, in fact, we can see that the amount of subsidies was very, very little. So what's the bottom line here is that if we had data sort of matching the subsidies and the history of the firms for those three countries, we have a rather comforting picture. Somehow, you know, they got it right. I'll stop here, but I have more evidence for
future. Yeah, and I think Carla actually has very similar story to tell, slightly different to Stefan's, right? I think it's important to understand a little bit what our data is telling us differently. So, Carlo, you have similar results in this respect, right?
Entirely similar. I did the same exercise, although we didn't discuss with Filippo, so it's really a blind experiment.
For very different countries, correct?
Yes, and for very different countries. So we looked at whether a firm was a zombie firm based on previous pre-crisis productivity data and turnover data. And so firms that were identified as almost defaulted by bank indicators, exactly. And then we realized that the amount of subsidies that went to these firms is actually very, very little. In our case, is less than 10% of the total. Although these firms, in terms of numbers, are maybe 22 or 20, some 20% of the sample, between zombie and quasi-zombie firms, they got less than 10% of the overall subsidies. Again, because they're relatively small, they're relatively unproductive, and because, since in any case, the way that the European framework on state aids has been designed, that prevented the use of the 100% guarantees, unless there were some very few cases, there was a component of bank screening in any of these loans operation. And that component of bank screening made sure the banks did not want to expose themselves to firms that were clearly unviable ex ante. So I think this explains why we're getting similar comforting results on the allocation of subsidies across countries. It is true that in Germany there are some slight differences, but maybe Stefan on this.
And if I may, Stefan, I think we need to understand a little bit how your results may be a little bit different in this respect. But I think if I may reiterate the point that that Carlo made about the banks, and also when little money was given to small firms, banks were not equally evolved, right, Carlo? In which case, you know, the screening element wasn't there. And of course, that adds to our ability to identify productive value, right? I think that's an important, perhaps, lesson in terms of how do you give money out. If you involve the banks, then you also have that screening method.
Yeah, it tells you that the policy design is crucial in determining the ex post outcome in terms of allocation of resources. Yeah.
So, Stefan, tell us, how are your results slightly different to what both Carlo and Filippo have told us?
Yeah, so they are not perfectly comparable because I don't have the amount of loans that firms get. I just know whether they got financial support or not. Right. This is the data that I have. And if you look at this, and maybe also this could be reproduced for Italy and the other countries, just yes, no. If you look at this, we see that those that received financial support used to be about a third less productive than those that did not receive support, if you take the fertility values from before the crisis. So it really disproportionately went to the least productive firms. And here I'm talking about financial support. The other important support scheme, the short-time work, to a larger extent went to the good firms, which is plausible because they have the trained workers, they face labor shortage, they would like to retain the workers. So this makes sense. So there's less of a productivity gradient if you look at short-time work. Actually, there's no productivity gradient there, but there's a strong gradient in productivity if you look at who actually received financial support.
So actually, if I understand you correctly, then Stefan, then the urgency of removing some of this aid is actually higher in Germany because, if you say, the probability that it went to least productive firms is greater, right? And that, of course, brings me to the next, I think, discussion, which is, okay, how do we can't have the drip on forever, right? We are vaccinating, the economies are opening up. Slowly, how should we do it? Should we do it quickly? Should we do it slowly? Should we sequence things? And if we were to sequence things, what should we sequence? What are your views on that? Stefan, I'll start with you because you also have perhaps the greater urgency to answer this question.
Thank you, Maria. So, I mean, of course, yeah, we have to make a decision here, right? We can't have these measures into place forever. So there is a tough decision to be made, right? And the question is when and how this decision should be taken, right? So It cannot be a decision that will make harm to no one, right? And this is not the option we have. And so even if we could fiscally sustain measures, we would produce a zombie economy in the long run, right? So the costs of this in the long run would be immense. So even if there would be the fiscal possibility, we should not go for a sustained support. So my proposal would be to quickly phase out these indiscriminate measures and replace them by targeted measures, right? And these targeted measures should support firms that used to be productive before. I take Filippo's point. We don't know whether these firms will also be productive in the future, but this is something that we cannot evaluate, actually. So that's not a true policy choice, I would say. So the policy choice should... The best we can do should be, I think, based on the past performance of those firms. And there are two ways that I see. And the first is to actually condition directly on pre-COVID firm performance, take some performance measures of the firms and condition help on this. But maybe the smarter way would be to be much more generous in the way firms can count their losses in the years 2020 and 21 against their previous profits, right? So this in the tax system, because this would automatically favor firms that made profits before, so that have been a viable business concept. And this is actually a proposal that also has been made by many observers in Germany, also the Council of Economic Experts and many institutes. And I think this is a very smart and easily to implement solution. And
can I ask you, Stefan? I'm sorry, I'll come back to you, Carlo and Filippo. But can I ask you, those firms that have made profits during 2020 also need the support the least. So why would you be supporting firms that don't need support?
Okay, so thank you for this point. I mean, if they did not make losses in 2020, they would not be able to use the measure, right? Because they could not deduct any losses against previous profits. So you would not help firms that did not lose. You would still help firms that had negative profits in 21 and 20, and 20, but you would only help those firms that used to be profitable before. That's the smart thing about this measure, right? So you're not throwing money after firms that have been the winners of the pandemic. This would not be the case because they would have profits in 2022.
That's clear. Okay,
wonderful. So, maybe one thing that I may add on some piece of research, additional research that we have done, Maria, this is regarding a survey of the surveys. So what we did was kind of looking into several surveys that have been made, sort of ad hoc, to firms, small samples of firms in a number of countries, in particular in Spain, Italy, and France. Now, these surveys were made at different times. So we call it, say, the lockdown period and the second semester of 2020. So basically to confront the results, right? And these were made with like a few questions to the firms, just to figure out so how much subsidies they got, who was getting the subsidies, and how they managed the workforce management, how much innovation they introduced. So just very standard kind of questions that you may expect to. And so that was not pre-coordinated. So what we did was a work of somewhat homogenizing these three or four surveys across countries before and after. But just to a bit contest what Stefan was saying, is that what absolutely we found all the time was that in the second semester, so not the lockdown period, so the first part of the year 2020, but the second part, actually situations somewhat improved in the sense that there was less, undiscriminatory or kind of covering up for the other firms. So it looks like very clearly out of this survey comparisons that, the government somehow got it right. So learned from the experience, and therefore really the subsidies went to to the most deserving firms. So some sense to say that when we are talking about covering up, we have to also to distinguish the first part of the lockdown versus the second part, and in a sense appreciating that the government actually were improving their giving out.
The focusing, but that's useful, And Carlo, you wanted to come in?
Yes, no. What we have been discussing in Italy is, since we still don't know what the new normal is going to look like, we are also started to move from general undiscriminatory target aid to targeted aid. And the question, similar to what Stefan was mentioning, is how to target, making sure that the aid then is received only by those firms that really require it. One way that we have been exploring and is now in upcoming in the legislation is this idea that you can roll over the loan, but the rolling over is subject to a number of, let's say, stricter conditions in terms of interest and in terms of maturity. And that would automatically, if you want, select those firms that sort of have a business plan, that believe that they have a viable business plan for the future. So in this way, you would make sure that those firms that decide to still have a bit of leeway understand that this leeway is, however, conditional to the fact that they are able to provide some earnings for the future years, rather than if you are in a negative position and you don't expect to recover, you know that this thing is going to be over very soon. There is also this French experience of participatory loans, basically what the French government has done, and Italy is thinking about following up on this. For medium-sized firms, the government is providing a first loss absorption guarantee on, let's say, equity loans that have been put forward by consortium of investors into the capital of medium-sized firms, which can present an interesting profile. So in this way, private resources flow to the viable part of the system, with the government only securing the lead that if there is a first, basically first loss absorption type of option. This is also an interesting experiment, I think, that Italy is considering with some interest.
Mm-hmm. I see. And Stefan, you wanted to come in on this issue?
Yeah, very quickly. Thank you. So we frequently use the phrase deserving firms in this podcast. I think it's good to clarify this a bit more. I think there are two layers here, right? Deserving firm could mean that this firm has been hit hardest by the pandemic. So this would be more the social politics approach. They would like to buffer any losses that employees might have. But my approach went a bit further, right? It was among the firms hit hardest, we should focus the money on the firms that have a future, right? Because they turned out to be viable before. That's a bit of a different angle. It will not mean that you give money to firms that have been hit hard, but that have been relatively poor before, right? And there's one social politics aspect that I would like to place here. So we have a new publication that's forthcoming in the Journal of the European Economic Association, where we show that actually the wage loss that workers face after bankruptcy of the employer depends on firm size. So if you are displaced from a small firm, you typically lose not much in terms of wages as a worker. So you can move on and sustain your earnings profile easily after a very short period of time. But if you are displaced from a larger employer, say having more than 50, having more than 100 employees, then you really face long-run wage cuts that go deep, right? So if you put the pieces together, right, the firms for which I propose to phase out support measures are typically small and unproductive. The losses the workers would incur in those firms are modest. They are relatively small. So the social impacts of this kind of policy are relatively modest, I would say.
Mm. Okay, well, listen, I mean, I wanted to, this is fascinating. I wanted to perhaps as a last point, and perhaps a little bit more speculative point, because because I want to look deep into the future, is to try and have, given that my company today is a company of experts on productivity, I wonder if you could try and predict sort of changes in productivity as a result of the pandemic. I mean, there is a very interesting discussion now going around where those who participate in this discussion are divided in the pessimists and the optimists. The pessimists who argue that, you know, productivity will actually will reduce, and others who see huge opportunities in the digitalization process as a result and think that, you know, teleworking is going to be the future and it's going to be a huge in productivity. I wonder what kind of your research on these issues and the way that you've seen the firms have been impacted. What does your intuition tell you about sort of long-term impacts on productivity? I mean, has this been an opportunity to cleanse out unproductive firms that should have been cleansed out, but were supported for some reason or another? Or is this a really distortionary shock that took away good value as well as bad value, and therefore, you know, new blood needs to come to the economy before we can talk about, you know, dynamism picking up? I know I'm asking a difficult question. I'm looking for intuitive answers, not answers that are necessarily founded, because you're doing predictions.
You actually touch a point of innovation that we didn't really talk about in the last half an hour. That was basically one of the most critical things that happened, really. When we look into this survey of the surveys that I was mentioning before, one of the questions was really, how much did you change your working, mode, right? So, and then how much new products you introduce and how much new innovation you put in, right? So these three clear digitally associated questions. And invariably, the response and the clear signal from every survey, which can tell us something, of course, out of the productivity development going forward, is that this was really just a realm of the biggest firms. So who was actually, faster in introducing information and technology, adopting, the most advanced products and so on, were by far the largest. So there is an incredible sort of divarication, in fact, between, what the micro and the small firm were able to do, and then the larger firm. Of course, this was even more substantial if we think about certain sectors, real estate didn't really have any innovation going on. So while instead ICT sectors, of course, were the ones that were most, affected positively by that, right? So so we have to consider that. If we consider, however, that if productivity is driven, as we know, from largest firm, the most intuitive and quick result would be, yes, productivity will increase.
Okay, so it's good. It's good to see that you're on the optimist side. Then that there are opportunities that are rising as a result of the most productive firms innovating, simply because they can innovate and they can drag the average with them as well. Carlo, are you as optimistic?
Yeah, I am on the optimistic side for a similar reason to what Filippo said, in the sense that what we do observe that during the crisis, first of all, as we mentioned, there is ample evidence of this cleansing effect of the recession, so the most productive firms being relatively less hit. And the second is, it is definitely true that on average, again, which means probably, again, large and productive firms, the shock of the pandemic has been taken as an opportunity to implement managerial changes, ICT innovation, reorganization of production processes, and streamlining. Just the macro evidence is that we had two lockdowns of similar magnitude. The first one produced a minus 15% of GDP quarter on quarter, and the second one produced minus 3. So there has been some adaptation for sure of firms, and this is productivity. However, I am optimistic in the medium term. I do think that in the short term, we have to go through this bottleneck of the phasing out measures, and this will create some potential social tension. So before we see the full light of the day, we have to go through some, dusk period, in which we have to be very careful in how we play the policy game.
And in fact, this is perhaps then, if I may follow your logic, this is where the focus of the policy should be in terms of trying to rescue value and so to focus it. But Stefan, you have the last word in your predictions.
Thank you. I could not support more what Carlo said at the end. So the policy will be decisive for these reallocation gains. I will not talk so much about innovation and digitalization within firms. I would like to talk again about reallocation and productivity gains that could come from cleansing effects. And one angle that we did not touch today was, those firms that gained from the pandemic, how did they look like? And we have data on this. So firms have been asked whether they actually gained from the pandemic. And if you look at those firms, again, it's the productive firms that gain. So the firms that used to be productive before the pandemic are much more likely to report to gain from the pandemic. So this would then even support this reallocation gains that we discussed from the negative side before, right? We talked about the bankruptcies of the least productive firms. This is one side, but we also see already now, at least for Germany, that the firms that gain from the pandemic are the good firms.
So it seems very much like, you know, those who would have gained anyway just accelerated their gains from the, because they adapted faster. You know, they never wasted a shock in terms of, you know, increasing efficiency. But are you, Stefan, I didn't quite get the how you calibrated your sense of the future. Are you also on the optimistic side in terms of not wasting a good crisis, or are you more uncertain about where we're going in productivity terms?
I'm relatively unsure on whether we would see many gains from digitization and home office. I don't know, and I'm a bit skeptical here. But I do expect, if we do the policies right, I would expect gains from relocation.
Oh, that's actually a good point. It's a good also point to finish. So it's interesting to hear you all being optimistic on this side. I think it comes also with the economies opening up, with all being vaccinated, and the summer coming up, dare I say. I remain a little bit more agnostic in terms of how I feel about this thing. I think there are issues that we haven't quite understood. I'm worried a little bit about scarring effects that may be a little bit more sustained. And of course, I totally agree with all of you that policy needs to quickly identify what the scarring effects are. And as we open up progressively the economy, we will see the scarring effects. Those scarring effects will have to show up a little bit more prominently. And I hope that policymakers who are listening will target those more than sort of the blanket measures, which may have been necessary at the start, but not quite as necessary as we progress. Well, with that, let me take this opportunity to thank you all for joining me this afternoon, this evening, dare I say. Stefan, Carlo, and Filippo, thank you for joining us from your respective home countries. I look very much forward to more research on this side, but this is all we have time for this evening. Thank you all for listening. And if you want to read or listen to this event, to the podcast series of Bruegel, you can find all the information on www.bruegel.org. That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much, and till next time.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.